AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 45 for Thursday, March 4th, 2010. Mets, Nets, and Jets. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free. Try searching for AutoLine After Hours at the iTunes Store. Well, here it is again. Thursday nights, as always, time for AutoLine After Hours. And as I always start out introducing who is here, I start with the auto extremist himself, Peter DeLorenzo.
John, good to be alive as usual.
Sure is. It's great to be alive and talking about cars and the automotive industry, racing, and the people who make it happen. And,
absolutely.
And as we've been saying for, it seems like, weeks and weeks on end, man, do we have a lot to talk about tonight.
Just never stops.
And also joining us, as always, David Welch with Business Week.
Always great to be here. Great to be employed.
Great to be employed. And you haven't corrected me. It's Bloomberg Business Week, right?
That's right, yes.
And we got a special guest coming in with us tonight, Sharon Silk Cardi from USA Today. Great having you here, Sharon.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And you've been telling me that you've been buried in a project here for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, about 3 weeks.
Three? Mm-hmm. Diving into the database of all these accidents involved with Toyota on unintended acceleration, right?
Right, right. I think it's what a lot of people are doing right now, just trying to take a look at what the cases say and, you know, what's really happening out there with people. The Los Angeles Times did something similar earlier this week, but I think ours is a little bit of a deeper dive.
Yeah.
Should be coming out in a few days, hopefully.
Okay. Watch for a big story in USA Today, but we're going to be mining you for data.
Good.
In the course of the discussion here. But I think we really got to start out with what to me is one of the big changes in this industry. We all knew it was going to happen someday, but Bob Lutz announcing that he's retiring. It catch you by surprise at all, Peter?
No. Remember, he was going to retire April of 2009. They announced he was going to leave at the end of 2009. But then Fritz said, well, why don't you become head of marketing? And actually, Bob tipped me off, you know, that video we had where we're standing around the vault.
Right.
He told me that day, you know, I'm thinking I want to get involved in marketing somehow. And so then he did that. And then, you know, the implosion, or after the implosion, then he was doing that. And then Big Ed came on board. And then, you know, over the last few months, it's clear that Big Ed has reduced Bob's influence dramatically in the last, 8 weeks. And, you know, he's just not going to hang for that. It's right. The end of an era. You know, a lot of our viewers don't know Bob. They haven't been around him or talked to him or hung out with him. And the guy is a singular figure. I think he's the greatest product guy of the last 35 years. And he will go down as one of the handful of great automotive guys.
David, do you think that Bob Lutz knew he was going to be announced as retirement when he got on the plane to fly to the Geneva show?
Remember, he announced his first retirement at Geneva last year, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
oh.
April.
Yeah, look, he's Swiss. No, that's his home ground.
Home show.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I've heard that, you know, he's been less and less happy for some time. And you know, you look at the things that have gone on really the past few months. You know, Mark Reuss's ascension is pretty obvious. I don't think Whitaker was marginalizing Bob because he didn't like Bob. But Whitaker's also got to build a team that's going to run this company for, you know, pick your number of years, but some time going forward. Stevens has got to be the product guy. He's got to make the calls that the company's going to live with. Reuss has to build the sales and marketing team because he's got to work with these guys. And the two of them, you know, they've got to basically come up with the cars, the sales and marketing pitch that's going to bring GM North America back. And, you know, if you you know, if you're basically starting anew with this team that Ed has put in place, then you know, you've got to give them complete control to build it. And you know, Bob is 78 now. He's, you know, as Fritz Henderson said to me, Bob is, you know, at 78 what a lot of people are at 47, but you know, still long term, you know, Bob didn't want to stick around a lot longer than this. So, you know, you got to give the two guys who are running it the chance to build the team.
Great points. Great points. But then we also saw big changes in the sales and marketing staffs, essentially split up. And what are you reading into that, Peter?
Well, you know, we talked about it before the show. I think it's Mark Royce is really stirring the pot. He spent 2 years in Australia. He ran his own show down there, and he really loved it. And he just, when he got here, he saw some things that he just didn't think were workable. And he saw a lot of the old hands, the old guard hanging around, and he just decided, this isn't going to work. I'm going to split sales and marketing up. And, you know, he left Susan Doherty there, but we'll see how long that lasts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, splitting up sales and marketing, I think, is the right thing to do, because I've always thought, in this business especially, they're two entirely different disciplines.
I mean, especially at GM, because the marketers play in the sales arena, which they shouldn't, and which is worse is the sales retail guys and gals playing in the marketing advertising arena when they don't have the first clue. And that's where GM has really run off the rails in the last 5 years.
Yeah, but, you know, what, sales in the auto business, you're dealing with dealers, and it's dealer relations. It's managing inventory and incentives. It's a lot of more left-brain stuff, but it's a sales job, and it's figuring out how to help the dealers move metal. The marketing side, and this is what GM has been bad at, frankly, all three of the domestics have, for the long time that people in this room have been watching this industry, have been bad at brand building. And I think it's because, you know, how many of their marketing people actually have marketing degrees? You know, a lot of them just came up through the sales side. And it's, and because of the business models they've had, it's been about the deal and the rebate and 0% financing and all of that. And, you know, just look at how many times they've even with the same agencies, changed ad, you know, ad pitch lines and marketing content and brand image, jumping, lurching from one message to another. They haven't been brand builders, and they haven't been consistent at it. And I think it's because they've had a lot of turnover, and because you've got sales and marketing people both working in the same, you know, same arena. Split it up and let marketing people do what they do. Now, do they have the right marketing people at the company? Yeah, it's tough to say. We're, you know, they may have to bring some talent in, or you know, these people are going to have to prove that they're the ones who can do it. That's a different question, though. At least now they've got it split up so these people can focus on the things they need to do.
One thing that I find interesting is, if I'm reading this right, no one's in charge of Chevrolet anymore, or Cadillac, or Buick, or GMC.
The whole divisional managers are gone.
They're gone. Right. There's no one person in charge of the brand versus the way Sergio Marchionne's doing it, of appointing a CEO of the brand with full P&L responsibility for the brand. And I'll tell you,
that's a good point.
I'm going to bet on Sergio's way. I think it's a disaster that no one's in charge of those brands.
Well, Sergio's way is the old GM way and GM's
heyday. A lot closer
heyday.
To it, right.
Now, whether Sergio's way is going to work for Chrysler, that's a whole other issue. But, yeah, Sergio's mind is in the right place, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it depends, too, on what your ultimate outcome is or what your goal is. You know, GM has needed to get away. If they're trying to have more sharing and lower costs and all the stuff that they've talked about for a long time, you know, I don't know necessarily that the old manager system still really works. I can see needing somebody who's in charge, but I'm not sure that having a boss of a brand anymore, they need the whole company to be on track. They need to have a whole vision for the whole thing.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that, but who's in charge of saying this is what Chevrolet is, stands for? It's like, you have somebody in charge of Chevrolet sales, somebody in charge of Chevrolet marketing. You have an engineering group that has to feed cars into it.
I guess it's going to be Mark Royce making that call now.
Yeah. To me, it is.
Sounds like he needs the auto extremist.
I would say so.
It's a good point. I mean, now each brand does have a sales and marketing head. I mean, that's what Jim Campbell does at Chevy. That's what Don Butler will do at Cadillac. But I know what you're saying, whereas, you know, who's the person who sort of lives this brand and figures out what it is? I guess it is going to be Royce. And it's a tough job, because it would be a tough job if you were Toyota and you had to figure out what Toyota and Lexus and, you know, Scion stand for, or if you were just, you know, Honda Acura, you know, or Nissan Infiniti with two brands. But I know they call it three channels, but within that third channel, Buick GMC, you've got two very different brands with different customers, and someone's got to figure out the right image for all that, make sure the product and marketing and everything line up. It's not that it can't be done, but it's going to be a tough job, and if, you know, Mark's got his hands full.
He's got his hands full because, I mean, he's in charge of the entire North American operations, right? And now he's got to make the decisions for all four brands that they've kept on top of that?
I'll tell you one thing about this, though. If you look at the new products for each of the four brands, the new products actually do a very good job of telling you what the brand is. The marketing doesn't, and because they haven't really come up with the creative. I mean, now think about, and let's be fair to these guys, particularly Cadillac. You know, Lutz just selected the new agency in, what, January? Was it early January? So the creative work, I don't even think, is out yet. Or if it is, very minimal. I haven't seen any of it anyway. So, you know, that stuff's going to come out, and we'll start to see what they're going to do. But, you know, you look at, like, the new SRX, you look at the CTS, you know what Cadillac's all about. You know, you look at the LaCrosse, you look at the Regal, you know, it's a more modern look, very nice interiors, quiet cars. You know what it's about. GMC is probably the brand that they've done the absolute best at defining with product and marketing anyway. And then, you know, Chevrolet, a little bit, you know, they've got a lot. They've got their work. That's where they have the biggest work, I think, in defining the brand.
I think you're right, though, that it's definitely the products that are going to do it, because I'm just so weary of pretty much all automotive commercials and marketing. Just, it's all just exhausting to watch. None of it is really good.
A piece in the Current magazine that, you know, the story probably should have gone online about an hour ago about what Chrysler is doing with marketing. And, you know, I like some of it. I don't like other pieces of it. But if you look at what Olivier Francois is trying to do, you know, that Super Bowl ad for Dodge, you know, Man's Last Stand, it didn't resonate with me, but I think it was a good ad in that, you know, when I checked last Friday when I was finishing the first draft of the story, there were over 2,000 comments of it on YouTube.
Wow.
And four women had done parodies, including two amateur filmmakers.
Well, the one parody by the women was really good.
The one by, what's her name, Mackenzie Fagan, who I interviewed for the story, was a great parody. and look, you know, these women didn't like the ad, but it got people talking. You know, now this is within the, you know, the realm of auto journalists and PR people and everything. The women at the auto shows that Chrysler had out there. Some people thought it was day class A. Some people thought, you know, some of the guys were saying, yeah, they're pretty hot. It got people talking. Now, the Chrysler stuff, the first ad that came out, the minivan ad, is, you know, it sort of had a 40s French jazz feel to it. It's not going to get people talking, but it's a minivan ad. But I think this guy is going to do some stuff that is going to be a bit more provocative and start to really, you know, get attention for them and build brands. And that gets to your point about automotive advertising being pretty rote stuff. You know, you may like this guy's edge, you may hate him, but he's going to do something different.
Just to make the point that you're making with some numbers behind it, here's the Ward sales data. Last month, Dodge Charger sales up 387%. Nothing's different in the car.
Nope. I mean, I don't know if they put money out. They couldn't have put that much money out.
I still, that's great. But I still don't see Chrysler, unless something really dramatically changes for them, they are going to be.
We also have to note, too, that Chrysler did a ton of fleet sales last month. A ton of fleet sales.
Is the Charger a big fleet car?
I doubt it.
I don't think
so. It could be, but I doubt it. Jeep had a fantastic. Well, here's the thing that I think a lot of people
miss. Cop cars for sure, but I don't know. We'd have to look, see where the fleet sales came from.
But to me, here's the big thing is, if you compare month-over-month sales, not year-over-year, Chrysler sales were up nearly 50%. Now, a lot of that was fleet, no question about it. But 50% is a massive jump.
I'd put a lot of fleet on that, just, you know.
Their sales were about 40% fleet, so.
They are month-by-month. Look, Marchione said at the auto show on the roundtable, if I have to do 40% of fleet, 40% fleet per month, you know, to keep the company going until the new stuff gets here, I'm going to do it.
Right.
And that's his only choice.
Okay, a 50% increase in sales, 40% of that, you said, was fleet. That's still a big increase in retail.
But there's a big reason. There's a big reason why we use seasonally adjusted numbers, and that's, you know, to deal with those month-to-month fluctuations.
That's correct.
Right.
But what I'm getting at is, and 1 month doesn't make a trend, right?
Right.
Okay. But we didn't really see the new advertising kick in until the beginning of the year, and so I'm saying, okay, don't compare just year over year. They were up barely anything in a market that was up double digits. The market was up 12-13%.
They were flat year over year.
Year over year. But they were up real strong month over month, much stronger than the overall market, much stronger.
Peter's right, though. The jury is way, way out because—
Oh, yeah. But I'm just saying, watch these numbers.
January and February of last year were horrific months. So if you're flat versus that, you didn't have a good month.
Absolutely true. But again, if you look at, I think I got it. But
the Charger thing is very interesting that they were up that much because it can't all be fleet. Look, the marketing for Charger, the man's last stand, like I said, Ed didn't resonate with me, frankly, because, you know, it makes every guy look like Homer Simpson's. And I do like 80% of the cooking in my house. So, you know,
I thought the copy was just great for what they were trying to do.
Yeah. And the Michael C. Hall voiceover is good. The other Charger ads where they're just talking about the car and all you see is the Charger have been very good. There's a web-only ad for the Charger targeted at women where there's this woman, and she's kind of pretty hip woman, you know, her boyfriend's throwing her stuff out the window. She's getting kicked out of the apartment. And then she picks up her Charger keys and she speeds off while they're playing the guitar intro for one of the Heart tunes back from the 70s. And it's a pretty good ad. And now this is a brand that appeals, like 75% of Dodge buyers are men. So, in fact, Ralph Shields told me when I was interviewing for the story that, you know, the brand is kind of bipolar because you've got the Journey and the Minivan, you know, which are sort of family-ish cars aimed at women, and the rest of the brands, you know, you may as well have hair grown out from under the hood with some of these cars.
But, you know, it's classic, though, because, you know, and I did it for 22 years, and I know what happens, but this new agency, they write this good stuff. And I don't know what the dynamic, I don't know if it was the client or the agency, but they've gone to that well, and they are beating it to death. Because they've already gone off track in this campaign. They had two or three good Charger ads, and now they're trying to do it in everything. They've got one with a minivan, it just doesn't work. So they've already, you know, they're already off the rails. And that's just the way the sense of time and place in advertising goes. They're already off the rails. They probably don't know it yet. And I'm sure the client doesn't know it yet because the client, you know, they're geniuses. But they're already off the rails. So if you're starting to see stuff, I'm starting to see stuff in the air. It's just like the wince factor kicks up for me. It's just like, oh, you didn't really do that, did you? So they need to stop what they're doing, rethink. Michael Hall's good for a certain thing, but what else are they going to do? So they got their work cut out for them fronts.
You know, all I'm saying is, you know, the point of my story is that this guy is doing things differently. He actually gets very upset if you say that he is being controversial. But this is a guy who, for Lancia, had an ad with Richard Gere, you know, driving a car from Hollywood to Tibet, and the sort of obliquely saying free Tibet, and eventually the Fiat had to apologize to the Chinese government. That's controversy. I mean, Tibet is a big deal with the Chinese. And, scantily clad models at auto shows is slightly controversial. Tibet's a big deal. And the guy likes to he pushes buttons with some of this stuff, and he gets some chatter going. Is some of it going to miss, to your point? Yeah, it probably is. But I'm just saying this is going to be something worth watching because it's not the same old, you know, car on the windy road, boring stuff we've seen from every company.
But one of the things I think that the auto industry makes a mistake of is sometimes just going for the, like, shock factor and the wow factor. I'm thinking of those Dodge commercials where the guys were standing at the urinals, like, that did nothing to sell cars except to have people talk, and it wasn't, had nothing to do with anything.
You're right. And,
you know.
You know, the you know, there is, and you commented about this when it came out, the ad that Chrysler did. It was a remake of a launch ad to free the Burmese dissident who's been jailed. And you know, if you read the buzz on the Internet, people thought it was a good thing to do because it's socially responsible and it's about freedom. Who doesn't love freedom? Well, except, you know, the Burmese government. But but what's it say about the Chrysler 300? It doesn't, you know.
Zero.
Yeah,
right.
But this, I mean, what he's doing is not what Chrysler did with Jeff Bell and Julie Rain, where you had, you know, jokes about wife swapping and, you know, sex in the back seat and the lingerie bowl. It's more sophisticated than that. And, yeah, we'll see how it works. I mean, they got to have product at its bottom line, though.
Yeah, they got. Well,
they draw people to showrooms, and they're looking at an Avenger and a Sebring.
I mean, they've got. What's up next? They've got the Jeep Grand Cherokee,
right,
which will be in showrooms with any sort of volume in June.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that.
Well, then they have the 300 coming later in the year.
Well, yeah, but later in the year, the right. 300 the new, and the Charger makeover.
Oh, yeah, look.
That's fourth quarter. And yeah. Reality, it's fourth quarter. No, it's really next January.
Yeah, that's when you get real launch of advertising.
So, I mean, real you know, volume. They got the Jeep Grand Cherokee, which you like, mm-hmm. which I like the look of it. I see how it is. I'm sure it's good. But that's it. So, boy.
Well, both cars are going after a market that's going to have a smaller pie than it was when, you know, when they launched these things originally, both because the market is dialing and because they're bigger vehicles with.
And they're going to put a new front end and rear end on the Sebring and change the name. And I joke that what is it going to be, the Tampa or the Boca? But that's not the problem. The problem of the Sebring is the greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't change that greenhouse, and you got right. it's still going to be a
pain. And no, they can't change that.
Yeah.
That's,
no,
that's big money to
retool. Once the hard points are set in place,
right.
It's just,
so, I mean, I wish them the best, like I always say, because all these people say, oh, you want them. No, I don't want them to fail. Would be bad for everybody, but boy, they got a tough road.
They got a tough road. But all I'm pointing out is the month-over-month numbers made me sit up and pay attention. Hey, but what do you make of Brian Nesbitt out at Cadillac, Peter? I mean, here's the first experiment in the industry of putting a designer in charge of operation.
Well, like I put on the site, so he's getting back to where he once belonged and where he belongs. And
he's brilliant at it.
Yeah, and he's really good at that, and he was very awkward in that role, and that was an experiment, and it's not going to work. And if I was at Welburn, I'd want him back designing rather than
right.
being the guy on Cadillac. And I think, you know, that probably for Bob Lutz was, because Bob was behind that, and that probably that change was just.
Well, the other thing, too, is if you're going to have nobody in charge of the divisions,
yeah.
you don't need Brian running cattle.
No, let him go back to work in his pen. You know?
No, but, you know, Nesbitt is a very good designer. He's not a marketing guy. Maybe he could be a good one, but it's sort of like the Yankees signing Curtis Granderson, terrific outfielder, and playing him at first base. I mean, it's, you know, sort of wasting a lot of his talent, maybe. And, you know, the thing about Cadillac is that
their sales are down.
Yeah, the sales are not good. And even for the new products that are really good. So, you know, and I'm not saying it's Brian's fault, but something's got to be done over there. And he's a designer. I mean, that's
right.
where he ought to be.
Well, the other thing interesting, if you go month over month, again, GM sales were down. They sold fewer vehicles in February than they did in January. And I got to believe that's when Whitaker said, or maybe Ed or Mark Royce said, enough is enough. We're making a change right
now. How much?
Now.
I mean, I wasn't looking at month over month. I was looking at year over year. And two things jumped out. One, that getting rid of the four dying brands, their sales were up 32%.
Right.
Now, the other side of that, though, is that they're going to be in a dead heat with Ford every month because they don't have those four brands. And we're finally seeing the impact of, you know, the sales volume had taken those four brands out. Now, who cares? Because you weren't making any money with those brands anyway.
Yeah. Right. We haven't even talked about Ford yet.
Yeah. And one thing that we got to, while we're still talking about Cadillac a little bit, David, you broke the big story. No Converge coming out. No
yeah, it's the
electric car from Cadillac.
Yeah. The you know, the thinking is that, well, first off, Bob was the big champion of it. This is the second time it's been killed. It was killed back in, it was earlier than May of last year. Wagoner killed it for budgetary reasons. And, you know, and then, of course, he was fired. They go into bankruptcy. And Bob always loved the car. He thought, one, you sell an expensive Cadillac, it's a better way to cover the cost of the Volt's technology. He's right about that. Two, from what I was told, he really thought it could be a different take on a luxury flagship. It's not a big sedan. It's not an Escalade, which is sort of the Cadillac flagship for a long time, which is not kind of what you want as the spearhead of your brand anymore in this day and age. And he thought, you know, a technological showcase, cool-looking sports car like the Converge could have been it for Cadillac. And I think he's got a fair case for that. But was a money loser. The other thing is that, you know, what I was told is that, you know, the car had like, you know, 20 or 22 inch wheels or something like that. And to make it a Cadillac, give it the performance it needs, the heavy luxury seats, all that stuff, made it so heavy that the range wasn't going to be 40 like the Volt. It was going to be about 20. So now you're getting the range down to the point where you're not much better than a plug-in hybrid. So it's not a great environmental story. It's a pretty good one. But also, you know, they were battling all those the compromises between, is it a great luxury car or is it a great environmental statement? And they just couldn't blend it all together to make a car that worked. And I got to think, you know, with Bob losing influence and he being, you know, one of the few real champions of it in the company, that it was just kind of dying out. So in late January, they sort of pulled the plug.
And also, you know, I liked it as a design statement, but also it gets back to how many coupe-like things do you really want? You have the CTS Coupe.
Right.
And it was very reminiscent of the CTS Coupe in a smaller package.
Right.
You know, that's what GM used to do badly. They would come up with something and then give it to all the divisions and immediately water down its presence in the market. So, you know, it was a good idea, but I'll take a CTS Coupe or a CTS V Coupe all day over the Converge.
Well, and you're going to see Cadillac, its green story is going to be plug-in hybrids, because the XTS, from what I was told, is I don't know if they've officially approved it yet, but very likely to have a plug-in hybrid version of the XTS sedan that we saw in Detroit. And the concept was a plug-in.
I still believe that the real car is going to have a longer wheelbase than what we saw in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
They'll probably do like an Audi A8, A8L kind
of thing. Yeah, that would be a real smart
but
thing to
do. They'll have a plug-in version of it, I think, and I was told you may see some plug-ins in other Cadillacs, other cars in the line, so that's going to be, you know, the story. And you think about a plug-in.
I think about a Porsche 918.
But you think about a plug-in, though. I mean, you need a lot less battery than you do for an EREV like the Chevy Volt. And, you know, depending on who you believe, the cost of a battery for a plug-in or an EREV or anything is anywhere from $500 to $1,000 per kilowatt hour, probably on the higher end. If you can get away with 6 kilowatt hours in a plug-in, you know, you're talking, you know, $3,000 to $6,000 if you can get away, you know, versus, you know, upwards of $16,000, you know, for something like the Volt. Now, GM says the cost is going to be lower, you know, whatever. I mean, we're talking industry-wide. It's a lot of money going in just to the battery. We're not even talking about the rest of the electric powertrain and the rest of the car. It's a lot of cash.
Well, everyone's going to think, Sharon, that we've been leaving you out of the conversation. But you told me that you've been tied up for 3 weeks now diving into this Toyota story and
right.
haven't been really following all this other breaking
news. No, I haven't like barely been reading email. So, yeah.
But bring us up to speed what you're finding with this Toyota thing, because it's not going away. I mean, some of the big news that came out this week was that people have been bringing their Toyotas back to the dealership to either get the floor mat straightened out or the pedal assembly
right.
replaced, and still reporting that they're having unintended acceleration problems with
right.
these cars. What's your investigation turning up here?
Well, I can't talk too much about it because I haven't done it yet, but trying to talk to people who have been in this situation and find out exactly what happened and how they've, you know, what exactly happened.
So you've actually talked to the people who have been filing some of these complaints?
Yes, some drivers. And, you know, it's all over the map. It's all over the map.
In what way do you mean all over the map?
I mean, there's people who were actually charged with DUI who have filed a complaint and say, you know, must have been sudden acceleration, versus other people who, you know, live to tell a tale of just a harrowing, you know, few seconds in their car where they couldn't get the car under control and still have no idea what happened, and, you know, talking about trying to get into neutral or trying to get into park and just complete panic and it doesn't sound fun.
No, I'm sure it doesn't. It's got to be terrifying for these people.
Right.
It's. I would imagine it takes quite a bit to motivate somebody to file a complaint with the government over their car.
Right. Well, the number of people who have complained has shot up since the news broke about, like, 40, 45 days ago.
I think that, and then I have to wonder about the hysteria factor.
Right. Well,
there is. There are going to be legitimate complaints, and there are going to be...
Oh, I don't doubt that there's legitimate complaints, but now we're going to get the bandwagon people. It's like, oh, yeah, I want a new car because, you know, this one's got a ghost in it or something.
Right. Well, and there's also the folks who whose family member had some sort of freak accident, and they have no idea what happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the guy who was in jail.
The guy who's in jail, we should explain a little bit. Some guy who caused an accident, killed a couple of people, wasn't that
He was on his way home from church, I believe.
Right. And they charged him with manslaughter.
Was
right?
that in Milwaukee?
I believe so.
And now they're saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe it was unintended acceleration that caused all
this. Well, his lawyer's saying that.
Right.
I was going to say, this is either, you know, unintended acceleration or a very, you know, a defense attorney who's grabbing
it. Well, he's been in prison for a long time. Well, I think almost 2 years or something.
Right. Well, I mean, there's all sorts of complicating factors with that case as well. I mean, apparently there had been, he's Hmong, and there had been someone of the same race in that courtroom like a week earlier who had been done something terrible and horrible. And so, you know, there's some thought maybe he got the short end of the stick based on his race. I don't know enough about that case. That one was not one that I was looking at. But
so how many people have you talked to?
A lot. A lot, yeah.
So how would you characterize them? All different kinds of people, all different kinds of ages, or what?
Yeah, I mean, there's a significant number of people who are older, have older accidents. But, you know, I say that to somebody and they're like, oh, well, of course, because old people get into accidents. Well, it's not necessarily you get your AARP card and all of a sudden you're a bad driver. So, you know, there's other factors. You know, maybe people who are older drivers don't have the same reaction time, so if something happens and they just can't react and they end up in a messy accident, or maybe they don't survive from their injuries like someone younger would, or I don't know. It's hard to really draw any hard theories on what's happening with people based, but what it does say to me is that this there has been for a long time this feeling that sudden acceleration just doesn't happen. I mean, I've had people tell me that it's an urban myth and it doesn't happen. It's always driver error. I've actually had, you know, safety experts in for the automakers tell me this, and I don't know anymore. I really don't know. After talking to a lot of people, I can't be someone who comes out and just says, yeah, it's definitely for sure always driver error, you know? And I think that that's part of the reason why Toyota took so long to really investigate this, because you can't, they're not going to accept that it's something wrong with their car. You know, it's got to be the driver's fault. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that's something you can necessarily say is always the case.
Well, I do think this electromechanical, the whole electronic thing, and I know nothing about it, but I have to believe there are glitches. There are glitches in all the electronic stuff we use.
Look, the sudden acceleration is real. The question is to what degree and how many of these complaints and cases are real.
And what's the cause? That's the big thing.
Yeah.
In fact,
what I understand is it's very difficult to replicate a software glitch when you're trying to find out what the problem is.
Well, and a lot of the thing, too, can be where the car was. You know, we ran a story a couple weeks ago that talked about this electromagnetic stuff. And I talked to an engineer at Ford, and he said that with the Ford Escape Hybrid, when they were testing it, the car would always die when they were leaving the certain supermarket in Southern California. They had no idea why. It would just, like, shut down. And it turned out that the supermarket had one of those, like, electric, you know, like, dog fences, but for their shopping carts. So if someone tried to steal a shopping cart, it would go off and it would notify somebody in the store who would come out and get their cart. But this is what was setting the car off and making the entire system shut down.
Yeah, somebody else told me of, I'm not sure if it was in California or somewhere in the South.
The cash register thing?
No. Somebody, they said BMWs would drive by a Marine base and the car would just die. And it was some big EMI thing that they were blasting out, electromagnetic interference thing, that would just, for whatever reason, it just knocked BMWs out. But here's another thing with unintended acceleration. Do we have that clip that I shot? Last week I had a Lexus IS. Before this show a week ago, I went out cross-country skiing, and I actually came back in here with my cross-country ski boots on. And look at this. Here's my pedal on this car. And as I push down with my cross-country ski boot on, the angle's not showing it. As I press on the brake, I'm also hitting the gas pedal. And so if I look down, I'm going to say, oh, yeah, my foot's on the brake, And we don't have the audio with it. This is a little bit better now. This is Lexus IS 250. So there I go.
So when you put the brake on, you're hitting the gas.
I'm hitting the gas at the same time. And if I look down, I say, hey, my foot's on the brake.
So here's a question, though. Is that driver error?
Yeah, I call that driver error.
You do? Now, or is that a design?
Because you shouldn't be driving with cross-country ski boots on.
And here we go. I went and got a tape measure, and I started measuring. What's the difference, the gap between the brake and gas pedal? We had a Ford Fusion here, a Pontiac G8, and this Lexus. And sure enough, the pedal on the Lexus is either a quarter of an inch closer than the Fusion, and I think three-quarters of an inch. The pedals are closer together than the Pontiac G8.
That's what happened to Audi.
You know what? Measure a Volvo the next time you get one, because every time I've had a Volvo press car, I can easily get a little bit of, when I go from brake to gas, a little bit of a flick on the side of the brake going down to the gas pedal.
So, but you raised the right question, actually, Sharon. Is it driver error, or is that a design defect?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think one of the problems with this, assuming that it's always driver error, is that you're just assuming that, you know, it's always this, like, sort of, that all drivers are moronic, you know, and that they can't get this done. But there might be actually something wrong with the car. It might not be that there's a, you know, faulty switch or EMI issue or whatever. It might just be, like, a pedal design flaw.
Right.
I think one of the things that the industry needs to also think about is we have to stop assuming that everyone is lying when they report something, because if you just assume that everybody's either lying or a bad driver, then you're never going to get to figuring
out. I agree, but I would add this. If you just say, oh no, it is the electronics, you're going to chase down a rat hole that may produce no results at all. I think there has to be an open and frank admission on the part of the regulators and the politicians who are diving into this that it could be idiot drivers. And if you don't admit that...
One, they won't admit that. But even if they did, what the government wants the car companies to do is to come up with cars that are idiot-proof. Mm-hmm. So they're going to force changes on them, you know, for safety anyway. And I'm not saying that's the wrong thing to do, but that's what they want. Fail-safe cars.
But that's how the cars are marketed to a lot of people. I mean,
right. I'm not saying it's the wrong thing, but I'm saying, you know, even if they can say, well, a lot of these sudden acceleration things are driver error, I don't think the lawmakers or, for that matter, the courts are going to care. You made a vehicle that an average person, you know, could easily end up, you know, barreling into a pedestrian or a car in front of them. And there was a problem here that could have been fixed with some small redundancy or some small fail-safe mechanism, and you didn't put it in. I mean, I think that's where Toyota is really blued and tattooed on this thing, is that they were one of, as far as I know, two car companies, Honda being the other, that didn't have some sort of override to cut the accelerator in these instances.
Subaru, too, based on my tests. There's a number. In fact, there's some big three products that do not have the brake override. I think Chrysler's had it ever since, you know, they got bought by Mercedes or Daimler, but...
Well, that's why I get asked, oh, well, you must be gloating about Toyota's problems in Detroit. And I said, I don't see any gloating, because we could get a regulation that would be very unpleasant for the whole industry.
And well, so, this is the point I've been making, is that this is not good. And I'm being accused by all kinds of people in the city of having sold out, that I'm pro-Japanese, that they must be paying me off. And I'm with you, Peter. This isn't good for the industry. And if it's true, and I don't know if your data showed this, but I know the New York Times, NPR, the Wall Street Journal did stuff on this stuff, Sharon, and it showed Ford Motor Company actually has a higher incidence of reported unintended acceleration issues.
Well, we did similar numbers. We haven't run them yet, but we did similar numbers, and we cut them slightly differently. What we did is we looked at the overall number of complaints and then looked at what percentage of those complaints were sudden acceleration. And if you look at that way, you see for Toyota that somewhere around 2004, they just had a big spike, and it has never gone down. Like, it doubled in 2004 into, like, 8-9%, and then it went into double digits, and it's never really left there since then. So something clearly is...
Yeah, it's not driver error. Some of them maybe, but there's something wrong with Toyota's cars, that they're having a higher incidence of complaints.
But when we talk about regulation, I say this, and it sounds like I'm joking, but I'm really not, because I really do believe that we don't do a great job of teaching drivers how to drive in this country at all. So one of the solutions I think should be that if you're going to market your car as completely safe and we care about your family and we've got all these airbags, that, you know, we don't let anybody, any other company say any of that stuff without a disclaimer. And if you're going to market your cars as safe and reliable and you're not going to die in them, then I think that you should have like a little star in your commercial that says, you know, may cause unintended acceleration. 30,000 people died in this car last year, or, you know, something to sort of balance out, because I do believe a lot of people bought Toyotas believing nothing would happen to them.
It's
in
true.
Those cars.
And the point you raise is a good one, because back when Ford was having the Firestone Explorer issue, Car and Driver did a fascinating test. They got a Ford Explorer, rigged up one of the tires, so by remote control they could blow it out. They took it out to the Michigan International Speedway. They had one of their drivers. They put in a roll cage, gave this guy a helmet, the whole nine yards, and they had him drive 50 miles an hour, blow out the tire, hit the brakes. Nothing happens. Kept building up the speed, building up the speed. I think they got it to the point where he was going 80 miles an hour, blow out the tire, hands off the steering wheel, slam on the brakes, and nothing happens. And I said even back then, okay, even if these tires are blowing out, there's no way in the world going straight down the road that that thing should go upside down unless you're a terrible driver.
Well, no, what they found
is... I shouldn't say terrible, unless you really aren't trained well to handle this.
Well, one of the things they found was that people did that, what do they call it, like the J, or the hook.
They overcorrect.
Yeah, so when the tire blows out, people panic, and they go to the right, and then they panic again, and they go to the left, and it's that motion that makes your car flip.
Wasn't it the also, though, that the things they did to rig up to blow the tires with the Explorer Firestone test were not the same as the tire stripping off and ripping? It was a different kind of tire failure, which can cause a difference.
Well,
we're getting into the weeds here on this thing.
Yeah, the majority of that, though, was driver error in my estimation. And also, like, 101, let's load up five people in this thing, and it's 98 degrees in Texas, and not check the tire pressures. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's good. That's a recipe for disaster.
Well, but do you think that driver education in this country has ever taught anyone
well,
to check their
no.
driver?
There is no, no question that NHTSA and the problem I've had with NHTSA and the whole Washington safety establishment is they have dumbed down everything to the lowest common denominator. Let's put more airbags in. Let's put more restraints. Let's do whatever we can.
Higher pressure monitoring.
Yeah, so that nobody is accountable for their behavior behind the wheel. No one, you know, takes the extra measure to get, and yes, we do not train our drivers. I mean, what president is going to get up or run for president? Like, I'm going to run for president, and I'm going to say, okay, everyone who drives will get $1,000 from the government, which will pay for half of your license. But things are going to be different. Of course, if I ran for president, I'd issue everyone a full-length mirror before they go out of the house, but that's a whole nother play. But no, we've done a horrible job. I mean, you know, it's...
But how do you train somebody to not do the J-hook when the tire on their SUV blows?
I mean, you're going to pay for everyone to go through Bondurant or Skip Barber? I mean, it's almost incomprehensible, but something's got to be done so it's better.
Listen, if you go to Europe... You don't just sit down, thumb through a book, and take a test and get a driver's license.
It takes months and money. But, you know, instead we build our cars. Okay, yeah, let's add more airbags. Remember when John DeLorean and Allstate triggered the whole airbag thing? You know, John DeLorean really went off the rails. The guy was a brilliant engineer, and then all of a sudden he was just like, oh, let's not have people wear seatbelts. Let's just pile the thing in with airbags. So, you know, you're not accountable. Yeah, you should expect to drive into a brick wall at 40 miles an hour and walk away. And that's the wrong approach. It should be driving dynamics, the ability to avoid situations, the ability to cope with situations, and the ability to perform as a driver in high-pressure situations. It's none of that. It's just like, no, you should be able to run in a brick wall and walk away. That's the way we want it in Washington.
Why not? I still like the idea that injecting the super foam into the cabin, like in that Schwarzenegger movie. Yeah, Total Recall.
Make mine whipped cream.
Latte.
Hey, it's time for Rapid Fire. We've got to...
Does Sherry know what rapid fire is?
You know what rapid fire is? We've got all kinds of questions from
Jason
our viewers.
Jason Fines with an AK-47.
Yeah. Here it goes. This is the graphic.
The visual is delayed.
Awesome.
Okay. Brent Donnie asks, what do you think of the recent failure of the Hummer sale? Is this Saab Part 2? Or is this a result of Ed Whitaker and his style of doing business? Yeah, why are all these sales? They couldn't sell Hummer. They couldn't sell Saab. Saturn.
The fact that they were so distressed that they're being sold essentially in a fire sale tells you that they're very difficult to make a go once you acquire it. And this is Saab Part 2, although, you know, Victor Mueller, through force of will, got the Saab deal done. In Hummer's case, it's a really tough business to turn around. I mean, in a way, Saab was in better shape because there was a product plan with some pretty cool-looking stuff coming down the pipe. Hummer's got nothing coming.
Well, Hummer's whole plan was, like, big and, like, smaller versions of the same thing.
Well, they never did the HX.
The H4, if they had the H4. But globally, the Hummer brand has a good image. It's only
there's
here.
There's no product coming. So whoever buys this thing...
Without an H4?
Yeah, and is GM going to joint... You know, our contract manufacture some of this stuff, and is there going to be an engineering relationship? GM does not want to get into any of these deals with a buyer who's not going to make a go of it because they're going to be on the hook for parts or manufacturing contracts, perhaps, or dealer franchise agreements down the line. So if the intending buyer can't make a long-term go, forget it, and that's what's happening with Hummer.
Your minute is up, sir. Michael Weber asks, he says, since Peter D. is close to Mark Royce, there's no way he doesn't have a better clue on what's going on than the rest of us. He says, John, maybe it's time to take off your friend of Renzo hat. How about an innocent question on AAH about what direction Peter thinks things should take?
Well, that would take about 47 shows, and since we're coming up on our 50th show, I've got some real clear-cut strategies for General Motors, but I'm not going to share them here. But I know what they should be doing, you know. But if they want to keep flailing around, we'll just keep talking about it.
There you go. Okay, Eric in Troy, Ohio asks, while Toyota's touching every one of the recalled vehicles, there has been talk that the fix may not work. With that, why wouldn't Toyota create a flash update to the ECM, the electronic control module, to put the engine at idle whenever the brake lights come on and reflash all of the ECMs as part of the fix?
Whenever the brake lights come on?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Probably means whenever you step on the brakes?
Yeah, all right. All you need is a brake override. I mean, if the throttle sticks open and you push on the brakes, it should actually de-throttle the engine at that point. But not every time that you just put your foot on the brake, I don't think.
And there's going to have to be a whole separate things for performance cars. Otherwise, they're going to be undrivable in performance situations.
Hey, is this a case for everyone to drive a manual transmission?
Yeah.
Your left foot's on the clutch? You got the handbrake right next to you, the emergency brake?
Oh, boy, if you think distracted driving's a problem now, let's see. I'm working my gearbox, I'm talking on my cell phone, I'm juggling my Starbucks.
Right.
Oh, boy.
But that's a great point. I'll bet you are there any reported cases of unintended acceleration with manual transmissions?
I bet you not.
Yeah,
because, you know, the great thing about a manual is... You have to drive it.
You have to know how to drive.
And you have to pay attention.
Being a driver of a Mini Cooper S with a 6-speed manual, I can tell you that's the case.
Okay, Dave Rakowski asks, and this is a good question, actually, can you explain the difference between sales and marketing?
We sort of talked about that earlier, where sales, you're working with the dealers who have to move the metal, it's incentives, it's pricing, it's inventory, dealing back with the plants as far as production and marketing.
Marketing is
advertising, brand building exercises, viral marketing, image events.
Image wrangling, public relations, you know, but it basically is image wrangling. It's what your image is, how you forge it, and what you want people to take away when they see your product, what they feel about your product.
Design.
It's design, it's the emotional connection. Sales is the retail nitty-gritty, grind it out. What have you done for me lately? You know, it's 6 o'clock on a Friday. How many units do we have out?
Sales is hard.
I sold for 8 weeks out of college. I sold that story. The general manager called me and said, Peter, you just marched to a different drummer. I suggest you go do something else.
That's great.
Well, you took his advice and ran with it.
Yeah, I did.
Hey, we got a phone call here. Let's bring in the one from Pedro Craig.
Hi, this is Pedro Craig from Emerald, Arizona. I was calling out a comment. I was trying to figure out why did Ford come out with a 5.0 V8 that gets better gas mileage than the EcoBoost? Shouldn't they have marketed the V8 in their premium cars, like, say, for instance, a Show SVT? You figure you detune that from 400 horsepower to down to 320 or 350, and it would get the same gas mileage. Almost seems like the EcoBoost doesn't make any sense.
I think he's confused with the V6 Mustang with 305 horsepower just delivered 31 on the highway, which is the most. They're saying it's the most powerful car with the highest mileage.
First time a car with over 300 horsepower got over 30 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, and now the new V8 5.0 delivers really good mileage on the highway. But I think there's a confusion there.
Yeah, because that 3-liter or 5-liter V8 has only been rated in the Mustang, right? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let's see, what else do we have here? GM employee says, here's my question. What happens to Toyota now that some people are reporting unintended acceleration continues even after the fix?
Yeah, Bart Stupak was making some noise about that today. And now, he's got politics. But I've read a couple of the complaints, and people who have had the cars fixed through the recall are still having unintended acceleration. And I'm reading a two-paragraph complaint, but they don't sound like crackpots.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the interesting things, too, is when you read through the complaints, seeing what people identify as unintended acceleration and engine revving noise is sometimes, and I haven't seen the new people who have said they've got their car fixed, but sometimes I think it might just be the car is making some sort of noise that sounds like it's going, and they don't know what it is, and so it's sudden acceleration. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case here, but it's definitely going to take some looking at.
Yeah, well, I still come back. I want to see a real good analysis of the demographics and the psychographics of the people who are reporting this.
And as you said, John, they're going to be dealing with this for a long time.
Long time.
And you've seen their new commercials. They're going after their buyers because they know, and that's a smart strategy. I was going to comment on this earlier. Toyota has to get the Toyota loyalist and keep them.
Mm-hmm.
They have to.
So the incentives they launched today, the traffic on, didn't the interest on Edmunds.com for Toyota go through the roof?
Oh, well, you can lease a Prius for $249 a month for 36 months with zero down.
And they had what? Corollas at $179, and yeah. I think Camrys at $199.
Yeah, and I wrote about this on
an M3 gets better fuel economy if you run them both flat out on a track.
You see, yeah, that's true.
There was that episode of Top Gear where they ran
yeah,
the M3.
That's cool. You're right.
And the Prius flat out, the M3 got better.
Yeah, no, that's cool.
Okay, William B. Slate asks, what competitors benefit the most and the least from Toyota's troubles?
Ford the most.
Ford and Hyundai.
Honda.
I looked at each of the major brands and did percentage increase sales for February. Number one, Ford. Number two, Chevrolet. Number three, Nissan. Number four, Honda. Number five, Hyundai.
Nissan had a great month.
Nissan had a very good month.
But how do you know?
Chevy had a better one.
How do you know it was just off of Toyota as opposed to incentives or anything else they're doing in a month?
Wait, say that again?
How do you know it was just coming off of Toyota's problems versus...
You don't. Yeah, I don't have that kind of number, granular detail to track what kind of buyers...
Because if you go to True Car and Edmunds, what they've been saying all along is that it was number one Honda, I think number two Ford, number two was, I think, Kia for a while at True Car. People, shopping...
Right.
The Toyota owners
and Kia Passcar had a blowout month. They did fantastic last, but only on the Passcar side.
And the thing about Ford, you don't post 43% increase. That is a broad Ford has really got some serious mo going on.
They do. Okay, Jason Jadosh says, why was the Cobalt recalled but not the HHR? Because, you know, Cobalt was recalled for this electric power steering.
Must have had a different steering.
It's the same. It's the same.
Different supplier?
No. It's the Pontiac G5 has
G4
the same.
In Mexico.
And G4 in Mexico. And the Saturn Ion. And they decided to recall the Cobalt and the G5 and the G4, but not the HHR and not the Ion.
Different suppliers?
No. It's they just said, well, they don't complain as much. That's what they told me. Because I had another guy call in to say he had an HHR, got in an accident. He said he was turning around doing a Michigan U-turn kind of a thing. The power steering died, and he went into a snowbank and bent up one of the fenders. And they're not recalling his car. They
just got to blame the driver. He should be doing more wrist curls at the gym.
Okay, George from Brooklyn, our friend in Brooklyn, says, who does the best automotive advertising right now? Sharon, who do you like the best for advertising?
Oh, yeah, I said that I didn't like any of them, but you know what? I really love the Toyota Sienna minivan commercials. Have you guys seen those?
I can't say that I've seen one.
They're the dorky family who's, like, thinking that they're cool in the minivan.
Oh, I have seen those,
actually.
They're,
like, making fun of themselves. I just think it's just the right tone. It just makes you sort of giggle. If you're a parent like I am and you know you're just not cool, you know, and everybody knows a minivan, it's just not cool, but sometimes you need it. And so I just, those commercials I really like right now. But
I have seen those ads, and I successfully blocked them out of my mind. That's my opinion of them. Okay. Dan Hudgens asks, in light of the ongoing management changes at GM, how long is it going to take for Big Ed to run GM into the ground?
Well, it's going to be interesting because Big Ed won't be the one that makes GM succeed. It's going to be the worker bees below him. It's going to be Mark Royce, Ed Welburn, Tom Stevenson. If they can keep focused and keep the stuff that Lutz, you know, got the direction Lutz pointed them, they got a shot. But Big Ed making a difference, I don't know.
That's not the kind of manager he is anyway. Yeah. I mean, he's not a product or marketing guy who's going to figure all this out. Yeah. It's going to be them.
Okay, got the message here. We got another phone call coming in. Carmen, let's bring in Jonathan Brown.
Hey, guys, it's David's favorite pizza guy from New Jersey, Jonathan Brown. Listen, I got to tell you, Bob Lutz is the man. They should not let that man get away. Mark Royce is great. He'll do a fantastic job. You know, it's all about making bold, proud statements, just like we saw with Chrysler. All of a sudden, Dodge Charger sales are up 360-something percent. It's because the consumers want that strong message. That's what they're buying. That's why Lutz is important. That's why Mark Royce is important. That's why the Dodge products are selling with these ads. The consumers want the fashion statement. Anyways, the show is great. Love what you're doing. Keep up the good work. And know we're listening to you out here at the pizza place in New Jersey. Thanks again.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Well, you know, quick comment. I was kidding about the pizza place thing, but what I want to know from Jonathan is if he's a real New York fan, he likes the Yankees, the Knicks, the Giants, and the Rangers, or if he's one of those mutant fans who likes the Islanders and the Mets and the Nets and the Jets.
Does anyone know where in Jersey he's from? Because I'm a Jersey girl.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Oh,
no,
he's
kidding.
Told us. And I can't remember which
I don't remember what he said. He'll probably email right now.
Yeah.
But, you know, Bob, he can't go forever. And I think he made a comment I read. He said, you know, in 12 years I'm going to be 90 and I want to drive down to Florida. I want to see my daughter. I want a bunch of things. And I know his wife, Denise, is looking at her watch like,
Yeah.
You know, she wanted him to retire at the end of 08.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what he said, though, at one of their Christmas parties was that his dad worked up until a few weeks before he died. And he wasn't sick. He just quit working and died a few weeks.
Well, I'm going to slump.
I just hope that's not a genetic thing.
I'm going to slump over at the controls and doing Auto Extremis, I'm sure, when I'm hopefully 90.
Hey, if you like what you're doing,
yeah,
why retire?
That's the key thing.
Okay, Peter, I think this is going to be, I'm going to give this to you. Jim 640 asks, do you see a possible way for U.S. F1, Formula One question here, to go ahead with any credibility with the Anderson-Windsor management in place, even if the FIA says okay to the one-year stay of execution? And just as a little bit of background, U.S. F1 is hopefully a U.S. Formula One team, but they've run into money problems. Anderson and Windsor are two of the people, Peter Windsor. So, and now
it's hard to talk about credibility when you're talking about the FIA and Bernie Ecclestone and Formula One because they have none. I mean, I wanted those guys to make it, but the reality is unless Bill Gates or somebody or Roger Penske or somebody says we're going to do it and we're going to win, any sort of a shoestring effort is just doomed to failure. I mean, they need like a serious, like Microsoft spending $1 billion over, you know, a 5-year period to make it work.
And what I see, Lotus just landed CNN as a sponsor?
Yeah, who knows? It's all crazy.
Well, it's all crazy, but that they must be spending some money.
Well, Bernie's got credibility when it comes to making money for Bernie. He doesn't have credibility for the enthusiasts out there who
Didn't he have one of the half-baked bids to buy Saab that never really got off the ground?
It might have been.
You know, you're right. I forgot about that.
He tried to buy, and he may have succeeded with this one. He tried to buy one of the biggest big English football clubs at 1.2. And
he's the second richest man in England, Bernie Ecclestone.
That's pretty good for him.
Yeah.
Okay, Otter Bruce from Twitter asks, did Akio Toyoda's appearance do a damn bit of good?
He had to do it for the politics,
you know,
of it.
It's like I wrote in my column about it on the blog. You know, it's like Danny DeVito said in War of the Roses, there's no winning. There are degrees of losing. He didn't do that badly. I think the buffer of the translator actually broke the momentum of the grilling, and I think that helped him more than anything.
Oh, it did help.
Yeah,
absolutely.
If he didn't show up, that
would have been
crucified, terrible.
But having that, I mean, you guys have all been in interviews with Japanese executives where there's a translator.
Right.
And you got, like, this round table with, like, 30 journalists, and there's a translator, and you got, like, 45 minutes. And nothing gets done.
Right. Deliberately.
Yes.
It does not get done. And they all, even if they don't speak English all that well, they understand an awful lot. And they use the translator as a way to really gather their thoughts, figure out what are they going to say.
Beyond message.
Right.
Give you something that's not really usable and break the momentum of a real Q&A.
Correct. Okay, well, we're at the top of the hour here, so we'll use this as the last one. Agostino Longo wants to know, have there been any rumors floating around about a next-gen V8 small block from GM? Smaller displacement, DOHC, fuel injection. It goes on a little bit, but you hear anything about a new small block, Peter?
A new small block has been rumbling around in GM for a while, and I know they have some prototypes running, and I know they have, like, in the range of a 3-liter all-aluminum V8. And all I can say to our enthusiast friends out there is go look up the Oldsmobile 215 cubic inch motor from, what was that, 60?
Yeah, I think that's right.
An all-aluminum block that ended up being, the tooling was bought by Repco in Australia, and it became a world champion V8. So there are some true believers at GM who are championing that small block, smaller V8. And I think,
but how many cars is that going to be in? I mean,
well, it's not just
injection 3.8 or 3.6 liter V6.
It's just not cars. It could be trucks. That's the only way that
absolutely
that would work. So,
but I'm talking which cars would it be in? I mean, basically Camaro,
Corvette, Camaro, and trucks, and a big Cadillac. I mean, if you have a big rear-wheel drive luxury Cadillac or Impala, you're going to need something like that. Now, yeah, you can do four cylinders, you can do turbo V6s, but there will be a need for a jewel-like V8, in my estimation.
Well, I've always said that when they really do drag that UFO out of Roswell and start to take it apart, they're going to find a small block V8 down deep in there.
I love that.
And as I said, it might run on dilithium crystals, but it's going to be a small block V8.
Yeah.
Hey, we're at the top of the hour here, so we will wrap it up. But Sharon, thanks so much for coming in. I can't wait to see your story coming out on diving into all these unintended acceleration people that you've interviewed. This is going to be an interesting article.
Hopefully.
Yeah, David, always great to have you here.
Always a pleasure.
Peter, great having you here.
Yeah.
Thank all of you for tuning in. Remember, we're closing in on our 50th show here. We'd love to have you just send in what has been some of your favorite moments. We'd like to go through some of that on our 50th show, our one-year anniversary. Just email them in. You can go to John's Journal. Ben set up an area where you can put in what your favorite is, or just email him at bsanders, for Ben Sanders, bsanders@bluesskyproductions.tv. And then remember, you can follow us at facebook.com/outofline Detroit. You can follow us at twitter.com/outofline. Always check out Peter's column at autoextremist.com every week. Check out David's stuff at businessweek.com. And
Bloomberg.com.
And which?
Bloomberg.com.
And Bloomberg.com.
And USAtoday.com.
And USAtoday.com for Sharon Silk Carty.
Thanks.
And thanks for joining us. Join us again next week. There seems to be no end to the news in this industry.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Passion for excellence.